Welcome back to the program. We face a vast array of global problems, not the least of which is our environment and the way in which the expanding Western industrial model of abundance seems certain to geometrically grow these problems. Many think that somewhere in some abstract way, technology will help solve these problems. But perhaps the same industrial system that created the problems is not the place to start looking for solutions. In short, it seems we can't fix the problems of industrial technology with the same tools that created them. That's where the work of K. Eric Drexler comes in. The world of nanotechnology and atomic precise manufacturing may hold the answers. K. Eric Drexler outlines these in his new book, Radical Abundance, How a Revolution in Nanotechnology Will Change Civilization. K. Eric Drexler developed and named the concepts of nanotechnology and atomically precise manufacturing and brought them to the attention of a broad audience. Currently, he's with the Oxford Martin School at Oxford University. It is my pleasure to welcome K. Eric Drexler here to talk about Radical Abundance. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you.
Great to have you here. Talk a little bit about nanotechnology and what it really means, because as you point out, there's so much confusion about the term. We think of it in terms of size, but in fact, it's also about precision.
Yes, the first thing I think one needs to understand about nanotechnology is that the word itself has no clear meaning. When I introduced the term and an initial concept of nanotechnology now over 25 years ago, the central idea was of nanoscale machines, productive machines, that could build structures, including other machinery, systems of machinery, and a wide range of products, a full range of products we see in our industrial civilization today, and a lot more, by working with matter at the level of molecules and atoms to build up from the bottom. The term has come to refer to anything in a small size range made by any means, and is often used to refer to material science, even though the largest area of nanotechnology today is the one that we're using right now to communicate. It's the nanoscale electronics that is on the chips that power the information technology revolution.
In fact, those digital chips are the apogee of where nanotechnology sits today in terms of its practical application.
Yes, very much so. And they're also a good analogy, very strong and effective and useful analogy for the prospective revolution of atomically precise manufacturing. The digital information revolution has been based on nanoscale devices that process the domain that they're working with, information, in its smallest little anonymous pieces, bits and bytes. If you now transpose that into a factory on a chip rather than a computer on a chip, that has nanoscale devices, mechanical rather than electronic, that move matter around and rearrange matter in the form of atoms and molecules rather than information in bits and bytes, that parallel goes surprisingly far to give a sense of the flexibility, the rate of operation, and even some of the emergent economic structure that one expects to see in a world in which the technologies of atomically precise manufacturing have been achieved and deployed in the world for application.
There has been so much talk lately about the notion of 3D printing. In fact, what we're talking about here is something that is arguably similar, but bringing it to a molecular and atomic level.
Yes, 3D printing is another very excellent analogy or parallel. In fact, I can relate that to the other areas of digital technologies. We see the ability to produce any pattern of sound today by taking sound samples and putting them together, whether it's to make the sound of a jet engine or the symphony orchestra. In images, you take the smallest bits of an image, the pixels, and arrange patterns of pixels under digital control, and you can produce any image. In 3D printing, we see a technology that takes little bits of matter, very large compared to molecules, but still fairly small specks of matter, and puts those together to make a three-dimensional, sometimes a functional three-dimensional object under software digital control. If you imagine a machine that works in a broadly similar way, materials coming in, digital information coming in, mechanisms that put little bits of material where they should be according to plan, that is an outline, a description of atomically precise manufacturing. If the operations, the fabrication, uses molecular scale building blocks.
In a sense, it creates, if it were to be successful and adopted on a larger scale, a whole new way of looking at industrial production, something that radically disrupts industrial production as a model as we know it today.
Yes, I titled the book Radical Abundance because the prospects are for production that's radical in several respects, radically lower cost, radically greater productivity of the mechanisms, radical reductions in the resource requirements for production, radical reductions in the unwanted outputs, far less pollution. Very, very precise control of a process, among other things, leads to a precise control of all the outputs. So there's no reason to have uncontrolled toxic materials or something like that. Those can be avoided. And finally, at the overall macro level, a very profound change in the economic structures around production and in the relationship of the entire physical technological system to the Earth and its constraints.
I want to talk about it in terms of its impact on economics, because when we look at traditional manufacturing today and we look at where the costs are, we see that they're in labor, in materials, and energy primarily. Talk about the ways in which this radically changes that equation.
Well, if you think of, let's take 3D printing as one model, or conventional printing as another, where you have boxes that sit on a desktop or larger systems to make larger products. They don't involve any internal labor. There are no hands down inside the machine that are working to do things in computers or any of these other systems. And that parallel holds here. You can think of this as a process that inherently and naturally has to be fully automated. So that speaks, I think, to the labor costs of the production process. If one then turns to distribution, the prospects there are for supply chains that are much shorter and simpler. You know, today when you get an automobile that has parts from pretty much every continent, starting with raw materials and metals, some of which are from Africa, and of course a whole lot of components and sometimes entire systems that are built in Europe or Asia. The prospect with atomically precise manufacturing is being able to take relatively, actually quite common materials, not scarce materials, and process them locally into small building blocks that then can be a little bit like ink for machines that then can make an extraordinarily wide diversity of products, things that range from photovoltaic panels to water purification equipment, aerospace hardware, a laptop computer with a billion CPUs, and yet running on stored energy and air cooled, and that. So now let's see. We've looked at a reduction in labor, in raw materials. Energy requirements are modest. They're on the scale of chemical energies. Land. Talking here about very small, compact machines. You can just go down the list, and if you run through the numbers, the conclusion is that the costs are dominated by raw materials and energy, and that the cost of products should be roughly on the range of a dollar per kilogram. Now, imagine buying a tablet supercomputer for a dollar per kilogram, or aerospace equipment for a dollar per kilogram. That's a very deep reduction in cost, and the actual expectation would be for a deeper reduction. At some point, we should emphasize that these technologies are prospective, that there is a visible pathway to these technologies, but they're far from being around the corner.
And in fact, though, the other aspect is what are both the intended and unintended consequences of this. When a tablet computer can be made that inexpensively and by anyone using these processes, what impact does it have for manufacturing and for economics around the world?
Well, one impact is as the basis for an enormous an enormous boost to global economic development. Today, when we look at the world in Africa, in Asia, in the rise of India and China, the prospects are for the world, you know, outside the U.S. and Europe and Japan, striving toward a standard of living that is familiar to us here, but that requires resources on a scale that it seems the Earth cannot supply or tolerate the use of, far too much use of carbon if one continues the rise of industrial civilization. So the prospect is for a way of avoiding the collision between economic development, global economic development, and the limits of Earth. And I see that as the greatest single impact. Beyond that, one can see the prospects for very large-scale economic disruption, which I think will require some serious consideration before the arrival of the disruptions. Mind you, we'll have some warning time there. And for management of a very disruptive transition period. One of the chapters in Radical Abundance describes this as managing a catastrophic success.
Right now, this exists. You've been writing about this since the early 80s. This idea of atomic precise manufacturing exists within the framework of known engineering principles. What do we still need to understand in order to move this further towards reality?
Well, a remarkable fact about the present situation is that the technologies necessary to move forward are far more developed than is widely understood. Sometimes people hear about atomically precise fabrication, and they think, well, that sounds like something very futuristic or science fictional. But in fact, atomically precise fabrication dates to well over a century ago. It's called chemical synthesis, in which chemists have planned molecular structures, atom by atom and bond by bond, and then gone through procedures that make those. And in those early years, a typical atomically precise structure, a specific molecule, would be on a scale of a few dozen atoms, perhaps. That has now climbed to a scale of millions of atoms in some of the current molecular atomically precise nanotechnologies. The main barrier today is that the research is conducted in an extremely fragmented way in many different disciplines, some of which don't, you know, scarcely know that the other disciplines exist. And to build toward the molecular systems, the increasingly large-scale and intricate devices needed to implement mechanical systems that can ramp the technology up further, requires bringing together different kinds of molecular components that are today capabilities in again, different branches of the molecular sciences, and bring those together in the context of a systems engineering vision. So the underlying chemistry and physics is all thoroughly understood. There are, you know, sort of routine discoveries to be made in practical applications, but nothing that is conceptually new. What is needed is a lot of detailed, coordinated work in an engineering framework, and this in areas where the knowledge is presently embodied in scientific institutions, and in particular in very small research groups pursuing diverse and different purposes.
And do the advances that have to be made, did they have to come in the world of engineering and systems manufacturing, or are there still questions within the realm of theoretical science itself about getting to this process?
Well, I think there's something that's important to understand about the kind of knowledge that I'm describing here, which I believe speaks to your question. We're familiar with technical knowledge coming in two forms, essentially the products of scientific research and of engineering design, which are, of course, very different because science is studying nature and building information out of what's observed, while engineering starts with plans and then uses those to influence what exists physically. They're sort of opposite directions of planning and information flow. What science does is to study nature and what's new. What engineering does is to design and build systems that can be made in a reasonably short length of time and can be competitive in a very difficult competitive environment in the world. To understand the prospects for technology, which really have nothing to do with the date on the calendar, they have everything to do with physics and the laws of nature, which determine the behavior of matter. To understand that is a process of exploratory engineering, and it involves applying engineering design principles to systems that, in fact, cannot be made in the near term, that will require new tools to make. And so it's beyond the framework of standard engineering practice. What one can do, however, and now getting back to the question of knowledge, is to base all of that engineering design and the quantitative analysis that goes with that on textbook science, very well-known, very familiar facts about materials and about the laws of nature. And if you listen to discussion of science in the world, whether it's in journals or in the media, it's overwhelmingly about what isn't known or what's just been discovered or what's questionable. But there's a huge body of textbook science where you give problems to students and expect them to answer the questions at the end of the chapter. And it's that kind of knowledge, those kinds of questions, that can be used to explore the potential, some of the potential, of future technologies. So what I have to say about these, you know, today and in radical abundance, is knowledge that is based by deliberate choice, avoiding unknowns, based by deliberate choice on well-known, well-established science and engineering principles.
One of the other areas that you look at are the geopolitical consequences, and that this idea of radical abundance will eliminate, in many cases, as you argue, the motivation for a great deal of geopolitical conflict.
Yes, the reason that I wrote the book, ultimately, is because of a concern for where our civilization is going, and part of that is all tied up in people's sense of competitive requirements, national interests, corporate interests, and those are very much a function of our technology, of the means we use for producing things. So my aim in the book is to provide a view of possibilities that can really reframe the problems and opportunities of the 21st century, that can serve as a basis for beginning to have a conversation about a different kind of future, one that can address some of the concerns that you're raising there. And at some point in there, I described this as beginning to nibble on a banquet of indigestible truths. It's very hard to come to grips with change of this magnitude, and what I believe is necessary is to start putting these prospects on the agenda, not to radically change our view of the future all at once or to embrace this very radical picture, but to recognize that there is something here, there is knowledge to be had, one can assess the ideas, one can begin to trace some of the consequences, enough to understand some of the reframing, again, of opportunities and challenges, and begin to fold that different vision of the future into the spectrum of possibilities that we actively consider in turning toward the future.
K. Eric Drexler, his book is Radical Abundance, How a Revolution in Nanotechnology Will Change Civilization. It's just out from Public Affairs. Eric, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you.
We'll take a break. I'll be right back.